This is Senate Committee on Judiciary. We're meeting January 29, 1987 at 3 p.m. in Hearing Room 343. Today we're having a public hearing and a possible work session on Senate Bill 323. We will be dealing with Sections 2 through 5, Section 6, Section 7, Sections 8 and 9, Section 10, Sections 11, 12, and Section 13.
Okay, it's... seven or eight minutes after three, which means I'm starting 7 or 8 minutes late, which I don't like to do, but members of this committee have other obligations right before this meeting, so sometimes we're going to have to start a little bit late. But in any event, the Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. Senators Brockman, Hill, Brenneman, and Fry are present, and the other members will be joining us shortly. We are continuing with our favorite subject so far in this committee, the only subject that we've taken up. And we're going to start with, let's see, everybody's, I guess we have the whole team here from OTLA, Charles Burt, Bill Gaylord, Lyle Valeur, and Bob Maloney. Were you all?
Not Maloney.
Not Maloney, okay. No, he's the wrong. He's the other group. Okay, we've got Bert Gaylor, and Valeur. All right, gentlemen, why don't you come on up here? We'll listen to what you have to say. No, we're dealing with the same. We should have been. Sections.
Oh, I think it's fair. Okay. Down there.
What this is a continuation, really, of a hearing on the sections of the bill that we started with yesterday. Sections 2 to 5 on punitive damages, Section 6, wrongful use of civil process, Section 7, 8, 9, and 10. And I thought we heard from the OADC yesterday. Is that this? We did? We're going to hear more from them today?
Only on these.
Only on sections 11, 12, and 13, right? Okay. And so, Kip, Jeff Johnson, Bob Maloney will also, and you will also be here on sections 11 through 13, is that it?
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay, gentlemen, proceed. As you each speak, please identify yourself on the tape.
Thank you, Chairman Fry. I'm Charles Burt. I'm Salem lawyer. I'm speaking on behalf of the Oregon trial lawyers at this time, although some of the comments I make may be from my own personal point of view. I'll try to separate them if I can. First of all, I have a kind of a unique experience. I think we're all agreed that what this started out as some 18 months ago was an answer to the question of insurability and the cost of insurance. And so, at least from my point of view, and I think from our groups, we've really earnestly tried to look at it on the basis of, will, what can we do to, if anything, to make this so-called crisis go away. I think it's interesting that the states that jumped right in, such as Washington and Florida and a few others, are now busily trying to jump back out again because they found it didn't work. I would certainly recommend the Oregonian's recent editorial advising great caution in proceeding like this, because there's every reason to believe that the multiple changes on the tort system and caps on damages have in fact not had one effect at all on the insurance cost or availability. And I think in the legislators that have gone for this bill of goods, they have found that the companies now readily admit that they that they knew all along that it would have no impact on their charges, and they've so said when they've applied for rate increases in Washington, for example. So with that in mind, I certainly am not totally negative, because there's no system that can't be looked at, and we should take a hard look at it, but I also say we should take a very cautious look at it. We're going to divide this up so as not to just to belabor the same thing over and over. I had a kind of a unique experience. I'm also a consumer of insurance. I am the unhappy part owner of a restaurant and bar. I say that tongue-in-cheek because I got a 100-year lease on it, and I don't know how to get out of it. And I decided to open it, which decision I made about 6-7 months ago. And at the time I decided to do that, I wanted insurance for all sorts of liability, including liquor liability. I went to a local insurance broker for a well-known company and got a quote for the limits that I wanted of $18,000 premium, which I thought was a little high. But I went ahead with my plans to open, and I formed the corporations, and then I took 3 months getting through the liquor commission, or four, and a few other commissions. And I decided I wasn't probably going to buy any insurance. But being a Scotsman, I hate to take any chances, so just before we opened, I went to the same broker and said, why don't you run that through again? Same coverage, same policy, same everything. I bought it for $3,600. So something's happening to the crisis. And as a consumer, I was very glad that it happened, because it made it a lot more affordable for me. That is, incidentally, for exactly the same policy. There's no difference in coverage. There's no difference in what it does cover. And it also includes fire protection for both the contents and the building, my share of the building.
What's the name of that place?
Well, I don't want to do that, but it's the Tahiti, and I sure like to see you down there. It's a small world, isn't it? Going back again for just a moment, Section 2 that you provide, we heartily endorse this. This is the solution to the punitive damage problem. I don't think it makes one bit of difference to insurance rates, but it ought not to be insurable, because punitive damages are not to punish insurance companies. They're to punish people and corporations who do really bad things. I might also say to you that I do a good deal of medical negligence work. I have never known of a medical negligence case where punitive damages were involved or were awarded. I can't conceive of one, because if you charge the doctor with willful and wantonly doing something, particularly, say, a death, you would be charging him with manslaughter, and that just doesn't happen. You may make a mistake, but I don't think anybody in his wildest imagination says that a doctor would willfully or intentionally cause harm to a patient. At least no lawyer that I know would. So I don't think it applies to that area at all, and it shouldn't be insurable by anyone. So if you talk about that, then that sort of eliminates some of the other problems with punitive damages. We agree, and we've talked now about Section 2, that should be enacted to make them uninsurable. When you go down to the question of how they should be divided, or what happens when a punitive damage award is made, I think we initially urged this committee or another committee of this body to adopt language which would, in effect, give to the state an interest in punitive damages by awarding one half of the net damage to the general fund or to the state fund. I think it's perfectly proper to do that. It is, in effect, something that is over and above general damages, but it's still something that needs to be done for companies and people who insist on doing something that is so outrageous that they should, in fact, be punished. So, taken together, those things, I think, come up to a pretty fair solution to it. Now, the only other thing that I would suggest, in Section 3, you use the term clear and convincing proof. This is a radical change in the element of punitive damages. We've got a long line of authority governing how punitive damages are found and how they're awarded. The case law has set a pretty tight limit on when punitive damages can even be asked for or obtained. And to change it to clear and convincing proof throws out a 50 years of hard case law that has now got good boundaries on it. So I suggest to you that it should stay the same, that it should be by a preponderance of the evidence, as it's always been. And certainly with the safeguards that the courts have put around the award of punitives, no one's going to be rushing off to a bunch of punitive damages cases. Frankly, I don't think that they've ever had an impact on insurability. I don't think they've, even in the drunk driving cases for automotive policies, now almost all policies exempt them from their coverage. So they really haven't had the impact that we're looking for. And again, bear in mind that we're trying to come up with something that will, if possible, defuse the price and cost and availability of the insurance.
Let me interject a moment. Is Mr. Rasmussen back in the office?
I don't know. He wasn't when we came down.
Well, what I'd like to have distributed to the committee members is a uniform jury instruction on punitive damages. The uniform jury instruction, I think, will help you understand what jurors are told if the issue of punitive damages is submitted to the jury. It's a pretty good concise statement of Oregon law on the elements that are required to be proved in a punitive damage case. Go ahead, Mr. Burt.
Thank you. I'm saying exactly that the safeguards around the award of punitive damages now by case law, as reflected in this court's instruction, which is always given because it is a uniform instruction, I think have provided a great safety net, if you will, for a punitive damage award to be given that should not be given. And I suggest to you that almost never are they awarded, and when they are, they're virtually never insurable. The last one I got was in Newport for a fellow who had run into a family head-on in their lane, blowing about a 3-1. That was his fifth drunk driving offense. He had another one before we got him to trial on this one. The jury awarded $5,000 punitives, which is uncollectible because he's uninsured for that purpose. But I think juries are very, very reluctant to award them, and it takes a really aggravating case before they start talking about punitives. In that case, I was a lot more aggravated than $5,000, and so were my clients, but the jury didn't see it that way. I want to talk just very briefly on this section 11.
May I interject a question to you on punitives and ask with your experience in that area, do you feel that at any time punitives ever filed for leverage in order to encourage settlement?
No, I don't think so. There may be lawyers who do think that is a method or something to do, but I don't think the better lawyers do that because it does not help you.
My question was, does it happen?
I don't think so. I won't say anything like that because there are lawyers practicing law that got out of law school last week, and I see some things filed that I can't understand what they are. But I'm saying lawyers that know what they're doing don't do that because it really doesn't give you any leverage. You take on such a burden to prove punitives that the only time you ever allege them is when you really think you got a good chance of getting them. I mean, it's an uphill fight. And I would rather, for example, in an aggravating case, frequently where I have a drunk driver in an auto accident, I don't allege punitives at all because I don't have to take on the burden of proving them. I'd rather have them get real mad at the guy and give me a bigger general damage verdict, in effect punishing without being held to the punitive damages. And I think most lawyers that try a lot of these cases would do it that way because it's so much easier. And besides, it's clearly insured then, you see. So there's not much motive to do it for leverage purposes, and particularly so when there's no insurance covering it. See, you don't motivate the insurance company to settle by saying you're going to punish their client. If they're not paying the damage, they don't care what you do to their client.
Well, it's unnerving, speaking as one that's had punitives filed against me, and of course, of being a mayor of a small community, it's unnerving. Especially, you know, when it's filed in a federal court and you're waiting that two-year period or whatever it is to come to court.
Well, I can share that. I've been sued, and it was unnerving without punitives.
Yeah.
I mean, just the fact that you're sued is never pleasant, and I have been, and I don't think it's nice. But, I mean, it's something you can't avoid. At least I wasn't able to. But I do agree with you, it's unnerving, and I think perhaps it's abused in some circumstances.
Me too.
But I'm saying that we can't make any rule that I know of within the Bar Association that can't be abused by somebody if they put their mind to it. I mean, there's no way that you can make any set of rules or regulations. I found that out when I was president of the bar. No matter how you want to structure it, discipline or anything else, you can find somebody that they put their mind to it can screw it up. And there's always a few people that'll do that, I suppose. It's unfortunate.
Now, before you said you were going to move on to Section 12. Does that mean that there's no more to be said from the three of you on punitive damages?
Mr. Chairman, let me speak to that.
Put your name on the record.
I'm Bill Gaylord. I'm a recent past president of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. We can do it any way you want. If you want us to go in order through the sections of the bill, we can do that. Or we do not intend to duplicate each other's commentary. There are a couple of sections that more than one of us will have something to say about.
I think I'd prefer to get rid of this thing section by section. So
All right.
If there's anything further on sections 2 through 5, then let's hear it now.
I think I think Lyle would each like to make a brief comment on the punitive damages question while we're there.
Go ahead.
Mine, I wasn't going to, but Senator Brenneman's question reminded me of something that I think might be worth mentioning to that point. I would agree with Charlie that certainly experienced lawyers do not file punitive damages for leverage effect or because they might scare somebody into the value of a settlement of a case. I don't think we can, you never say never, and I don't think we can account for everything that everybody does in the bar. I think there's a different dynamic that may be more at work than that one. I think there's a tendency with younger lawyers and less experienced lawyers to oftentimes feel that they have to do whatever there is allowed for them to do for fear that they are missing something they should be doing, if that makes any sense. I think there's a tendency to sometimes overplead their cases because they don't have the experience to know that it just doesn't make sense to do that. And so rather than exercise caution against overpleading, they tend to go the other way for fear that they'll be letting their client down or missing a tool or an argument that they should have available to them. I think that is a dynamic that probably increases the number of times punitives are pleaded. I don't think that the number of times they are pleaded has much effect on what really happens to the outcome of those cases. I paid close attention to the Commission on Judicial Branch hearings for the last 2 or 3 years, not the last year so much, but before that. And prior to the last legislative session, they studied the question of punitives and did a survey of Multnomah County. Of course, that's a group appointed by the governor to advise the legislature on legislation that might improve cost and efficiency of the court system. And their conclusion after studying punitive damage awards in Multnomah County was that they are so insignificant in number and amount and overall impact that it didn't bear any kind of consideration for legislation. The point you make about being the target of them and realizing that it's an unhappy situation to have somebody throwing punitive damages at you, and the concern that they might have a threatening impact when somebody asks for $5 million on a punitive damages case where their real damages are $500 or something. I think one of the proposals that we suggested to the interim committee might be worth considering if that's a serious concern. And that is that you simply eliminate the ad damnum clause or the prayer, the place in the complaint where you put a number for how much you're asking for. We've suggested that, and there are mechanisms to solve the other problems that raises. The insurance company, for example, needs to know how much is out there so they can set their reserves. This is the law of Washington State. It's the law of a number of states, and there are easy solutions to it by a relatively private document. The parties the plaintiff can be asked to submit a statement of how much they're asking for, which goes into the court's file and is available to the other side. But it doesn't get press coverage. It doesn't have anywhere near the wallop impact. And if somebody is raising their punitive damages prayer for the sake of the impact or the coverage they'll get or what have you, that's gone if you do this suggestion, if you eliminate the prayer of the complaint. I noticed in some paperwork that came in my office this week that the American Trial Lawyers Association has just passed a resolution proposing that to be adopted in all states as the same solution to the same idea.
I think if you don't mind, I'd like to, if that's of interest to Senator Brennan, and it probably would be, I imagine the publicity by itself is a little unnerving on that, but that's one of the things I would like the committee to think about later on, and that is the elimination of the amount sought in the complaint, because you know a lot of what's going on is the public perception that every injury is a big $1 million case, and they get that from reading newspaper stories about the mayor of Newport getting sued for $1 million, for example. Whereas if you weren't allowed to put in the complaint the amount of damages sought, why there wouldn't be a news story about these big cases to start with, and that might help take away the impression that's in the minds of a lot of the public that all these cases are big, horrendous cases. And as a personal matter, of course, I think it'd be a little easier on defendants if they didn't read a complaint and see that somebody was after $1 million verdict. That in itself might be a little difficult to abide by. Well, anyway, that's something we can think about later, but
I might mention that this document, the Oregon Insurance Affordability Act, contains our proposals to the Interim Legislative Task Force on all of these subjects that are before you, and that's in the packet of materials you have. And I think it's Section 3C that is our proposal for a bill to eliminate the prayer and the complaint.
All right, go ahead. Lyle, did you have anything to add to this?
Yes, Senator. I'm Lyle Valour. I'm a lawyer from Eugene, practicing primary plaintiff's law, and I have a little bent from my two colleagues here, because the first 14 years I practiced law, I practiced in Medford and primarily did insurance defense work, and so I've seen the issue from both sides. And just on the issue of punitive damages, as you, I'm sure, you're well aware, that punitives actually, by what we all thought up until the late 70s, were actually uninsurable in Oregon as against public policy. And then in the late 70s, a case came down and said under the broad definition of damages in an insurance policy, that could include punitive damages unless otherwise specifically excluded by endorsement to the policy. And the net effect of that is that most of the major writers in the state of Oregon, and I'm sure that if you all go home and look at your own automobile policies, you'll find that punitive damages are excluded by that endorsement. So the net effect is punitive damages aren't written or aren't covered. In Oregon, we only had that brief flurry of activity for a couple of years in the late 1970s when punitive damages was actually an insurance question. Quite frankly, getting to Senator Brenneman's question, when I was defending cases, I loved to see young lawyers coming in with a big punitive damage prayer, because, number one, it demonstrated to me they didn't know what they were doing, and number two, they were overreaching, and if they went in front of the jury, we'd never move to strike it. We'd love to have them take it in front of the jury on a straight negligence case, because chances are it would get stricken out before it went to the jury by the court, because they could not meet the standard of proof, and we never have to really worry about the jury ever even considering punitive damages, because they just couldn't get there. But it would demonstrate to the jury overreaching conduct on the part of the plaintiff in a negligence case. And to that effect, I think that it had a salutary effect as far as insurance defense lawyers were concerned. I don't think anything that you do with punitive damages, because of what has happened in the state of Oregon, will in any way affect the premium dollar that Oregonians pay or the availability of insurance in Oregon, because, quite frankly, it is simply not an issue in negligence or casualty insurance.
Okay. Any questions?
Just a reaction, I guess, though, you'd have to admit it would cost the defendant additional dollars out of their own pocket to defend themselves on punitive charges, right?
No, because in that instance, if they want to hire a lawyer, they can. But remember that the indemnity provisions of a policy under Oregon law and the cost of defense are separate covenants made by the insurance company, by the Oregon Insurance Code and by Oregon law. And if there is an allegation that is insurable in the complaint, the insurance company owes a duty to defend the defendant on all allegations made out of the complaint. Of course, they have to give him the opportunity to have his own lawyer on that issue if they so desire. It's the same as an excess situation, Senator. They're separate covenants within a policy.
Any further questions, Senator Brenneman?
Go ahead. I'm just thinking, I guess more of a comment. It seemed to me back that time, it's been 10 years, though, that we had to get separate coverage paid for by city at city expense to protect our interest on punitives because we weren't covered. And I would think that would be an additional cost.
Should have sued your insurance company for the cost of that defense because you did have a covenant within that policy of a duty to defend if you had an insurable action listed in the complaint, and your city should have gotten that cost of defense back from your insurance company. It's done quite often in commercial litigation.
Well, my memory's not so good, I guess. No, I can't remember back that far.
Anything else, Senator Brenneman?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. All right, the next subject matter.
Would you prefer we go then in order through the sections?
I prefer that we cover, I don't care whether you go in order, but I prefer that whatever subject you start with, that they be completed, the minor three of you.
That makes sense.
I would think, in keeping with that, while we have divided these among ourselves, I think we'll just go through them in numerical order, and then each of us who has something to say can say it there.
That's fine.
All right. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Section 6.
I tell you what you might do now. Again, each time we change voices there, if you just start off by repeating your name so we get
sure.
it on the tape.
Be glad to. I'm Bill Gaylord. I'm a lawyer from Portland. Section 6 of the Senate Bill 323 is a provision doing away with what we think of, we always call the special injury rule for lawsuits based on wrongful use of civil process. This is the subject we think of as malicious prosecution or wrongful use of process. It's the lawsuit that somebody brings because they got sued, sometimes referred to as the backlash lawsuit. Let me step out of that for just a moment and preface all of my remarks, and I think that it probably applies to the rest of my colleagues' remarks too, adding a little emphasis to what Charlie Burt said previously. The evidence has grown emphatic over the last year and a half that none of the things that have been proposed by proponents of so-called tort reform will cure the insurance crisis, prevent the next insurance crisis, save anybody a nickel in insurance rates, or make insurance more available in any jurisdiction. And I say that as boldly as that, in part because of some of the documentation that's become available just recently. Again, in the packet of materials we've submitted, there's a document that looks sort of like this. If you see the logo up in the left-hand corner, that's a cover sheet by the National Insurance Consumers Organization. But what this contains, stapled together, are a number of letters and reports from insurance companies regarding Florida, where most of the so-called tort reforms you're considering have been adopted, and where the major insurance companies have now gone back in and made their proposals for rate increases the same as they would have without it. And they've gone back through their last couple of years of claims experience and applied all these new tort reform laws retroactively to their closed claims and come to the conclusion that it wouldn't have made any difference. And they've even broken it down for us into separate parts of tort reform. And you can look item by item here and see where the zeros are, where they say that the impact of having had this law, if it was in effect before, would have been no change. So I think that's, again, that should be the consideration that overrides your consideration of proposals. There's nothing that I know of that changes that with respect to this special damages rule. I think the special damages rule is under attack because there is a legitimate consideration of the question of frivolous lawsuits. Now, I don't believe the evidence would support a claim that there is a real explosion of litigation. And that's been argued and discussed, and many of the materials we've submitted to you will supply that, and I'm not going to go through it in detail. There's lots of statistics on all sides. But we do agree, and we have recognized in our proposals, that whether it has anything to do with an insurance crisis or not, and we think it does not,